Welcome back to the MindHack Podcast, your source for actionable strategies to upgrade your mindset. I'm your host, Cody McLean, and in today's episode, we're joined by a guest who brings a refreshing dose of optimism to the conversation about the future. I'm thrilled to welcome Justin Bean, author of the thought-provoking book, What Could Go Right? Designing Our Ideal Future to Emerge from Continual Crisis to a Thriving World. His journey from Silicon Valley to becoming a sustainable strategist has given him a unique lens through which he views our future, a future where technology uplifts rather than undermines. In this episode, Justin and I dive deep into the potential impact of AI on the future of work. We explore the potential challenges and opportunities this technology presents, but also how we can leverage these advancements to create a future that thrives. So without further ado, please welcome Justin Bean. So we know we're in a place now where we have Mark Zuckerberg, we have these leaders at the top of these executive companies, especially in the technology space, where initially they had this kind of goal of like having an impact, a positive impact on society. And now we see often these companies, they don't have that kind of idealized positive impact on society. And then the leaders of these organizations either have to really shift a mission, which is really hard to do when you have a company that has a structure and board and equity and people want to make money, but simultaneously you as the original leader, like what was the, you know, Google's original motto, do no evil, is it's really arguable to say whether that they can really sustain that as a motto, because they put their shareholders first. And so how do we get into a society that is able to encompass everybody, not just the people at the top? I mean, this is getting kind of more philosophical in a way, which I don't know that you have all the answers, but what are your thoughts?
I don't think any of us have all the answers, but I think if we all pool our minds and our efforts and resources, we can get to a better place. And so, and this is sort of where I started from in this whole journey of thinking about what could go right and looking at the conversations that are going on in the world today. When we look at the future models and the stories that we tell ourselves about the future, they're so often very dystopian. And so we focus so much on what could go wrong. How can this trend line go into, you know, Terminator scenarios or immense concentrations of wealth where it's just slums surrounding small, you know, crystalline towers. And there are trends that are moving in those directions. But we've also seen a lot of trends moving in the right directions. And I think it's really important when we ask these types of questions to be able to zoom out and appreciate how far we've come, not just as a few people, but as a race of humanity that has become much more wealthy, much more educated, much more empowered all across the world from basically every country. So if we just take the American example and go back to the 1800s, when people were still dying of dysentery, they didn't even know what bacteria really was or how to solve that with antibiotics. No one knew about health food or vaccines. Many, if not most people, were illiterate. And child mortality rate was immensely high. It was around 40%, right? And that's dropped to around 4%. All of these trends, I think, are obviously have increased or improved in the right direction. We have more democracy around the world. We have more education. Literacy is almost 100%. And because of the technologies that we've brought in, not only from the first industrial revolution, right, where we got immense increases in the amount of energy and the amount of physical work that could be done for free or, you know, vastly multiply the work of one human being, we're now getting that from digital technologies where we're vastly multiplying the amount of mental work and amount of collaboration that human beings can do. And now with artificial intelligence, that's another step change, if not exponential change, in the amount of work, but also the amount of impact that we can have. And those types of digital technologies, unlike physical goods, are basically zero marginal cost to share with the world, right? You have much more marginal cost when you're increasing the number of physical goods. With digital, you can pretty much provide 1 million people with a service for around the same cost as one person, right? Granted, hosting, you need to pay for all those things. Entrepreneurs know that, but it gets cheaper and cheaper as you scale, right? And get your economies of scale and can even become free to the consumer with things like advertising models, like you, like said, what we've seen with Google, then it has been able to spread immense amounts of knowledge to people. So when we zoom out and we look at these trends, we can see that we're actually on a really good path where most of humanity now has access to the full breadth of human knowledge. And I know this is sort of old news, but I don't think we've even seen the beginning of the impact that that's going to have on the world and the amount that that empowers entrepreneurs and returns us from a gilded age that we've been building up to more of a distributed economy and one that is more empowered, where more and more people become entrepreneurs, which is a natural human state, right? If you go back before more centralized capitalist or centralized socialist economies, you've got markets everywhere. You've got a blacksmith, you've got a farmer, you've got someone who, you know, sells textiles and clothing, and everybody was sort of involved in the economy in a much more ownership fashion. And I think that's more of our natural state than selling our labor to a, you know, large organization that doesn't give us ownership. And so with the rise in entrepreneurship that we're seeing in developed countries, because in underdeveloped countries, they still have immense amounts of entrepreneurship. But in developed countries, I think we're starting to see a bit of a U-turn and going back towards distributed economies and ownership economies, where more and more of us are entrepreneurial or involved in a family business or business with friends or with people that we meet through online networks. And we have more of a say in our own destiny and more empowerment from all of the tools that we have at our fingertips for more and more reasonable cost every day to be able to have immense impact on the world. We just need to make sure that that's sustainably done from an environmental and social standpoint.
Yeah. And there used to be this kind of enlightened age of entrepreneurs when you had we had so much optimism for what these tech companies could do for society. And now we're kind of at the other end of that, where we no longer idolize the tech CEOs, the Elon Musk in some ways. I used to idolize them. I don't anymore. There's so many things that we end up in this culture now where we realize that these tech companies and these entrepreneurs aren't really able to save us. And so then what is the next thing that we should be doing as a society? Should we still be putting our faith into tech companies as being the means to help us as a society into the future to solve the climate change and other sustainability crises?
That's a really great point. And I think there is an awakening that is happening where people are realizing that no one CEO, no one tech company, no one industry is going to save us from the challenges, the grand challenges that we face in terms of climate disasters, social destabilization, and understanding where we're going in this world of technology. And a lot of the sort of utopian stories that we saw around technology companies, some of them have become dystopian and some of them are fine and they're just a part of life. I think we really quickly incorporate these new technologies into our lives and then just expect them to be there. And then we start looking at, hey, maybe this isn't perfect. Maybe we should criticize some of what's going on. And it's fair to say no human being is perfect. I think Elon Musk has done an immense amount of good for the world in helping us shift to an electrified transportation economy and now even more with energy economy and with the space race. Despite all of the criticism of the space race, I think that's going to be really helpful to humanity. And in the much longer term, keeping that light of consciousness alive throughout the ages, if possible. But I disagree with Elon Musk on a lot of issues, and I agree. I think he's sort of, maybe he's just too busy and he hasn't given himself the amount of time that he needs to really focus on these issues and think them through clearly. I was just on a road trip and I saw a Tesla with a bumper sticker that said, "I bought this before we knew Elon was crazy." And so I think this is a pretty widespread sentiment of sort of losing our heroes and losing this sort of naivete that anyone's perfect or any of these people that we idolize are 100% pure, 100% more intelligent than all the rest of us. And I think that's happening in the way we view government, in the way we view business, in the way we view these tech CEOs and entrepreneurs and kind of everything. And so it's almost like as a Western society, we're sort of at this sort of late teenage phase of, you know, losing our innocence, but also realizing that it's up to us. And we really need to be the ones that come up with the solutions that empower us to move forward in the future. And we're the ones who are seeing the problems, because we're on the ground in the industries, seeing the problems that need solving. And this has always been the challenge with civilizations as they reach their peak and then, you know, go over the edge there, is that you get these elites that are disconnected from the way that the world works on the ground, and they end up diverting resources away from serious problems into more luxury and entertainment. And we sort of lose our foundations and crumble. But I think there's something different about today. And what's different is the widespread availability of information and the transparency that's coming into all of these facets, from government to business to people's personal lives even. And that helps us to adjust our models of the world so that we know where it's wrong. If you talked about something like Iran-Contra back in the 80s and 90s, it was just this huge mind shift that the U.S. government could ever do anything that was unethical. And now I think, especially with millennials and Gen Z, it's just an expectation. And if anything, we're actually too cynical about the world and about our society and where we are. And so it's like we're going through this sort of evolution as a culture of, you know, losing our heroes, losing our innocence. And what usually comes from that is some soul searching and trying to understand who we are and what's important to us and what we value. And it kind of gets back on a personal level to what you were saying earlier, that in the entrepreneurial journey, most entrepreneurs go from a place of subsistence living or, you know, not having immense amounts of wealth, and then building a business, getting to a point of good abundance, those who are successful, because it's not everybody, but those who do, and they realize, hey, it's great to not have to worry about survival anymore. But now, you know, what do I do with my time? I don't want to just sit around and watch TV. I don't want to just waste my time on entertainment. What do I do? What's important? And what's going to help me live a meaningful life? And it relates at the personal level and the societal level. And I think we're kind of going through that all together. And part of the reaction to that is the rise of populism, right? People are not trusting the institutions that they once believed in. And they're realizing that there's a lot of corruption in government and business, and especially when they collude together. And we can do something about it. We're so much more connected in our online worlds and groups that can help us organize in the physical space. And I think what's happening is we're seeing a decline in fit for purpose of the established way of doing things. So these institutions totally made sense 100 years ago. They made sense 500 years ago. They made sense 50 years ago. But as we have reached this sort of abundant digital age with free availability of information and the higher ease of coordination and collaboration between people and access to capital, access to, you know, hiring people, to collaborating with people, we're realizing we may not need some of these established institutions anymore. We might be able to just handle some of this on our own in a more distributed and democratic fashion. And there are technologies that can support that type of collaboration or that type of democratic self-determination of a culture. But it really comes back to human beings. We're not at the point yet where we just say, hey, there's an AI that we can ask any question to and it will go and go forth and do what we say. AI can help us understand the world better and collaborate better, but it's still on us.
Yeah, I think when we're talking about the systems in government and how they're unnecessary for the phase of society that we're at, I think nobody's arguing against that. But simultaneously, Congress exists as a means of creating new laws, not undoing old laws. And it's right. Really difficult, as we know, with all the bureaucracy, to have an expectation or an idealistic future that we're going to solve, which I think is in some ways what has furthered this bridge between the left and the right, because nobody trusts each other anymore. And that's a whole thing onto it of itself. But I want to pull out of that, actually, and revert back to this idea of what can entrepreneurs do to help our future. And as you noted earlier, where we have this lack of meaning per se, and I personally experienced that as somebody who's built and sold multiple businesses. And now I sold a company that had 1,000 people and I'm very well off. I never need to work again.
But yet I've jumped right back into it, trying to make money and trying to work again. Because in some ways, I look at it like the greeter at the Walmart. You know, this is not everybody, but often the person is older. And it's not because they need to be the Walmart greeter. It's because they enjoy that interaction. And they decided that they wanted to retire. And they realize, wait, I'm bored. I have no meaning anymore because I'm no longer working at a company. And as a part of our society in the US, we've often kind of associated this desire for meaning with our work. And the moment we don't have that, then we crave it again. And that's what a lot of entrepreneurs are on this path. But before we jump into that, actually, I have a further kind of meta, which is that, say, 20 years ago, kids, if you ask them, what do they want to do when they grow up? Well, I want to be a police officer. I want to be a firefighter. And now you ask them, the number one thing is to be an influencer. And that also even relates to this other concept of building businesses. And back in the heyday of technology companies, we were so optimistic about, we're going to solve climate change. We're going to go to space. We're going to do all these things. And now that we look at as entrepreneurship and as the skills necessary to build a business have become more disseminated throughout society, what have entrepreneurs been doing? They've been creating online courses. They've been selling knowledge. They've been building apps that effectively are just more niche versions, more niche SaaS subscription services. And we have a million different CRMs. We have a million different to-do list programs. So we've been doing the bottom of the barrel, which is getting money for ourselves and not really like outright solving these existential problems in society that we had hoped that people would do. So I'm curious your thoughts on how do we get out of this place where the number one thing that people want to be, or Gen Z, is they want to be an influencer, which doesn't really benefit society. I don't know. And how does that relate? How can we not only change that, but also how does that relate to motivating and inspiring those who want to be entrepreneurs to be less likely to create an app that's going to generate their money, but is more likely to spend 10 years creating something that's solving a problem in society? That's not the easy path, but it's the best path for society as a whole.
Yeah, we don't need any more sock delivery apps, right? There's too much work being done in areas that are just maybe to make somebody some money for a short period of time, but those businesses don't usually last anyway if they're not really solving a big problem. So I think part of the phenomenon that you're describing here is that we get these new inbound new technology innovations, or enabling platforms, as I like to say, that we saw with the internet and with mobile phones and smartphones, right? And then we got all of these really big challenges and these big businesses built. And then sort of at the end of this, everybody's competing over the last remaining sort of pieces of it. And I think with things like generative AI, because we've had, you know, artificial intelligence for a very long time, but this is a change in the way that people are able to interact with it and use it and deploy it to solve challenges. So I think that's one part of it, is like when a new enabling platform comes along, then all of this new innovation is spurred and people create it in different directions. Now, like where they choose to deploy it is another question. And with the influencers, yeah, I don't have a strong opinion one way or the other. I think it's, in one way, if we were to look at it, it's disseminating the entertainment industry to the hands of more influencers. Instead of, you know, we tune into a few different television stations, and then that sort of broke apart into different like YouTube stations or different podcasts, right? Like this is disseminating the ability of people to spread ideas and sell entertainment and whatever it happens to be, right? And so in a way, I think this is democratizing the entertainment and educational industries, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. It's just sort of a question of what do we consume, right? You can still go to the grocery store and buy ice cream at the same time you buy a head of broccoli. And part of that is consumer choice. But I think that there are such immense challenges in terms of climate change and societal challenges that we, like, one, need to solve. And two, there are immense rewards in solving those challenges. So as someone who is working in climate technologies and seeing some of the big companies and startups, they're working on these. Anytime someone makes a criticism of some type of climate tech, I see an opportunity, right? It's this classic argument with like electric vehicles, for example, that people say, oh, you're just switching a tailpipe for a coal stack somewhere. right? And you're not really solving the problem. That's not true, right? Like, one, there's electricity required to run the oil pumps and, you know, everything that goes into mining coal, and then the distribution and shipping those fuels around the world, and then burning it at about 15% efficiency in a combustion engine and all of that. So all of that is not true anyway. Electric vehicles are more efficient by far. However, when you look at the battery, for example, those batteries are going to expire in 10, 20, maybe 30 years if they're built well. What do we do with them? And so this has been a legitimate criticism of electric vehicle batteries and of things like wind turbines, that they're very difficult to recycle. Even solar panels, they're 95% recyclable, but that's mostly because of glass. But some of the persistent challenges of recycling those are still troublesome. And so when we look at that, we could say, well, that's a problem, and we're never going to solve the challenge of renewable energy. We're never going to solve the climate challenge. Or we could look at it and say, maybe there's an opportunity here. And this is what entrepreneurs are so good at, is really looking at the challenge, looking at the problem, and saying, I think I have an opportunity to solve this. So when we look at EV batteries, there are many companies spinning up and scaling even today in anticipation of millions and millions of electric vehicle batteries. Companies like Redwood Materials, Li-Cycle, Serba Solutions, et cetera, that are building new businesses to solve this big challenge with part of climate tech. And that's just one example. But there are many opportunities for, you know, building software, building solutions for companies that need to comply with new climate regulations. So government does play a part in this in some cases. And then when you look at things like the Inflation Reduction Act or IRA in the US, that's sort of bridging the initial gap in the private markets to get to a place where we can have a functioning and flowing economy in the climate tech world, and bridging the cost gap for R&D and figuring out how to solve the challenge so we can get to a point of commercialization and scale and really disseminating those solutions out to the market.
So thus far, we've had society that every time a new problem or a new technology comes along, there's always this fear that it's going to impact the jobs available. Now, we've had that fear with AI, and every time that a new technology comes, so far that inevitable crisis about how capitalism functions, every time it's always threatened with this new technology. But every time a new technology comes out, there's always new problems that are created from that technology. So can that keep going effectively? Are there always going to be new problems created that are going to sustain more jobs? Or are we likely going to have to pause the way that capitalism functions and try and figure things out based on a lack of new problems and jobs?
Yeah, I want to touch on what you talked about in the first part of that, which is the big companies kind of doing the innovations and everybody else fighting for scraps. I think it's kind of the reverse, actually. These big companies are really great at building dynamos. It's just kind of once you get them turning over and once you get them moving, they're really efficient at pumping things out. But they're essentially pretty terrible for the most part in actually innovating to the level of a smaller entrepreneur. Granted, they have way more resources and they're trying to build these venture studios and they're trying to build these innovation groups. And some of them are doing a good job, but they can never compete with 100 startups trying to do the same thing that will eventually, someone will figure out product market fit. Someone will figure out how to scale that. And then the big companies are better at M&A. And better at incorporating those startups. And actually, they're pretty terrible at that too, right? Often a big company can steamroll a startup and make it really difficult for that to integrate into the big company and then, you know, get moving. So a lot of the startups actually get shut down. But those that work, it's a great way for the bigger companies to take something that startups have sort of, you know, competed for in the market. Someone rises to the top as solving the problem in a better way. And then that gets acquired by the big company and is able to scale it out and really solve the challenge for the broader markets. But I think your point you're bringing up around, does every solution create more problems? And does it create a challenge for employment and for people to participate in the economy? And I think yes, but every time it's happened, things have changed. And so if we continue along the same path, as we did in the 1800s or 1900s, it's just not going to work. And we brought about factories, and then agrarian societies just didn't work as well, right? Like, we were able to mechanize and industrialize agriculture, but cities were built based on the people coming to work in the factories, and then now the office buildings and everything else. And now with a new sort of paradigm shift with artificial intelligence that's able to decouple thinking and mental work from the human brain in the same way that machines and robotics decoupled physical work from human muscle and animal muscle, we're going to see a big change. And this may change some of the way that capitalism functions. But if it's truly capitalism and not oligopoly or monopoly, then that's how we solve the problem, is that more and more people are able to access it to create new businesses and create new ways of working. Because so many of these solutions are platforms for buyers to meet sellers. Now, one of the questions is, what happens when you don't need people to work, so you can't really pay people, and then there's not the demand you need to run a business? And so I think there's a few really interesting dynamics here. There's a great book called The Zero Marginal Cost Society by Jeremy Rifkin. It has like the longest subtitle I've ever seen. It was like IoT, artificial intelligence, machine learning, every technological buzzword, and the eclipse of capitalism. And so it was just like really long explanation, but great book. So it looks at not only how all of this is increasing the amount of work that people are able to do, but if capitalism's good at anything, it's about reducing costs for things. So as we move further into this, we may see a reduction in wages, but we're seeing a really dramatic decrease in costs. And so when you get to a world where you've got renewable energy coming in, basically getting free fuel from the sun or from the wind or from the ocean, and that fuels automated robotics, which are able to do work and construct things and build things for us, but also are able to maintain and rebuild renewable energy capture infrastructure, right? You get this sort of virtuous loop where automation starts building its own infrastructure for feeding energy into the system. And then it's able to maintain and build more robots and more automation so that more of the things that are being produced are lower and lower cost. So when we get to a place where, let's say, something that's sort of tangible, like autonomous vehicles, right? I took my first Waymo ride in San Francisco and did a cruise ride also. And it was amazing how quickly that just became kind of normalized. Now, they charged me about the same as Uber or Lyft, but their margins over time are going to be so much larger that that's going to start eroding, and they'll come down pretty close to cost because of competition. And so when a ride doesn't cost you $10, it costs you 10 cents, then essentially, your costs of living have gone down immensely. And so the amount of wages you need to earn are also pretty low. But I think there's a change that could happen where your ride might actually just be sponsored by the restaurant that you're going to, or the school, if you go to a school, or it's just offered because everyone is exchanging work to each other. And it really makes us question these institutions like money. What is money and how does it work, and who has the right to create it and exchange it? I worked on a project for IDEO. IDEO did a financial empowerment challenge, and we came up with something called Community Coin. And it was the sort of child of a lot of conversations around what is money, how is it created, how is it funneled down to the rest of us so that we can exchange it. And that's by an institution that decides how much money there needs to be. They print it, you know, or why give banks the right to keep a certain amount or disperse more. Basically, it's, you know, monopoly on money printing. But there's so many other types of exchange that we have available today and we will have available in the future that could be created differently. What if you could create money at the point where value is created? Because there's a lot of value created in the world that is not recognized by monetary exchange. Like if you look at parenthood, anybody who strictly looks at parenthood through the lens of economic exchange would say that motherhood is completely useless and fatherhood is completely useless. And there's no monetary exchange, therefore it can't be measured, therefore it's not valuable, which is absurd. It's probably the most valuable work that a human being can do for another human being, is to help raise them and bring them up in the world. if we were able to recognize that value, that would be immensely compensated, but it's not. And so I think what may happen in the conversations that we have in the coming years is that we need to, you know, this is our time to rejigger and refigure out what an economy is and what it means. And so there's all this unrecognized value that's going on in the world because some people have access to money, which they're able to exchange with others for some work. As a baby, are you able to go and earn money so that you can pay your mom to take care of you? No, and that would be absurd anyway, right? Like your exchange medium is like cuteness and love. And for that, you're getting caretaking and love and nurturing and all these wonderful things. And so I think we just need to expand our understanding of value exchange in the world and recognize how little of it is actually marked and valued and measured and exchanged for money. And in that understanding will come better ways of recognizing the value that human beings are providing to the world, shifting that to ways that are more sustainable. Because when you ask people what they want to do, most people don't say, I want to be an accountant. Like, no offense to accountants. Some people really love the puzzle of being an accountant, but let's just use it as a straw man for now. Most people don't say, I really want to organize other people's money through a system of rules that somebody else made up for some reason. And that's my purpose in the world. Most people say, yeah, accountant is a good job, right? You get a license. It's a secure way of earning money. There's big companies that'll pay you. You can get a job anywhere. Great. You can live well for exchanging your time to shift money around in different boxes and numbers. I would be a terrible accountant. There are plenty of people who are amazing at it and love doing it. But when you ask people, if money wasn't an object, what would you do with your time? Most people respond, and there's plenty of surveys and studies around this. Most people would spend more time with other human beings, providing more community, emotional, social, psychological value to each other. And they would work on more interesting projects. They'd work on solving challenges that they think have meaning in the world. And so one of our grand challenges is climate change. How can we create a sustainably abundant economy where our energy is renewable and clean, the way we get around is clean, the way that we produce and manufacture things is clean and circular so that we can move products into the market and back into production so that we can reuse it and not just send it to a dump somewhere? And all of these things are ramping up extremely quickly. So this is already happening. This isn't just some philosophical meandering that we're doing here. If you want the hottest areas of VC investment, it's in climate tech. And so while the overall market of VC investments declined last year, climate tech was up. When you look at the end of the year, climate tech had gone down, I believe it was around 6%, but the rest of the market was down around 40%. When you look at things like EVs, right, you saw an 8% drop in the overall automotive market. At the same time, you saw a 65% increase in electrical vehicle sales or electric vehicle sales. And so whenever we start looking at these places in the economy, where's the opportunity? Even if you don't care about anybody but yourself, even if you don't care about solving these challenges, even if you're just selfish and you want to make money, solve climate change, be a billionaire, right? Not only is it going into the traditional areas of energy and transportation, it's diversifying. And VC funding and private funding for smaller companies and mergers and acquisitions is going into more areas than ever. So not just energy and transportation, but sustainable textiles, sustainable real estate, sustainable food across the board. And so these are the areas that you want to be in over the next decade or two, because you'll have a more success. You'll be more likely to run a successful business. You'll be more likely to find funding. And you'll be more likely to find meaning in what it is that you do and more likely to feel great about waking up every day and doing something. And you'll hopefully find more connection with other human beings that are working on something that's meaningful and important. And to follow up on your other point, with artificial intelligence, this is helping to help us reach that more zero marginal cost society where we're getting more and more things for nearly zero marginal cost and we're able to cover it with other areas. It helps us to rethink how we go about an economy and what participating in an economy means. And with the rise of entrepreneurship comes the rise of an ownership economy where we all get to own a piece of the economy again, whether that's through stock or whether that's through owning our own business or whatever it is. But the trends are clear that we're all getting more involved in the economy and people are shifting away from traditional work in many ways. And there's so many new opportunities opening up that there's a lot of work to do. And so there's a lot of work for all of us to get involved in. And it has psychological, emotional, and economic, environmental benefits across the board.
I end up having like 10 questions and I have to throw them all away because we're going from point to point, but I love it because you touch on so many super important and really big questions in society that aren't really asked that often. And I love the focus on the entrepreneurial perspective because effectively what you're saying is that we need to undergo a shift in what we value as a society away from this creation of money and hope and expect that technology will effectively eliminate the need for money as the exchange of value, which is why money was created to begin with. And if I understand it correctly, you're saying that we should hope that technology will create an economy in which we don't have to have an exchange of value through monetary means, but we can exchange value through other means, whether it's like raising a child, spending time with somebody, all those things that we know and we derive a sense of purpose and happiness from. It's like they say that if you're depressed, go and volunteer. Like it's impossible to be depressed if you're doing volunteer work. And I know that we have so much anxiety, depression, et cetera, today. So is that kind of where you see us going? But also we end up having like the tech CEOs, Mark Zuckerberg or Peter Thiel, when we see these stories of them building their Armageddon base. And I think that's this other concern that's been growing as we see how does the monetary system work? How does society function, the global economy? And there's always this fear of this kind of collapse. And hopefully we can get through this collapse on the other side, if that so happens, where we are able to shift to this positive kind of Star Trek-like society where we're all able to work towards a common goal and money isn't really an obstacle. But it is the question nobody can really know is, are we going to have to retreat into our bunkers for a period of time? Or will technology also be able to shift government policies in a way where we're able to have a slower transition away from monetary as a means of value, which is also associated with that lack of meaning that so many of us seem to be experiencing?
Yeah, I mean, I named my book What Could Go Right for a reason and not What Will Go Right. A lot of people label me an optimist. I'm optimistic about some things. I'm pretty pessimistic about others. Like there's very much a world where this spirals out of control. Artificial intelligence enables terrorism in a way that it never was before. The electrical grid goes down and 90% of people in the United States starve within a year. These are extremely horrible outcomes that none of us want. And so I don't think any of them are outside the realm of possibility. But I think there are so many trends going in the right direction. And more importantly, it's up to us to envision what we want the future to be. And part of, I think, what's going on is that we're waking up to the fact that this is kind of our responsibility, right? Like we can't just put this on a politician. We can't just put it on some, you know, tech CEO. Like they're powerful, but not as powerful as all of us doing the work that we do to make them irrelevant and build this better world that we want to see. But the first thing we have to do, like you said, we don't talk about this enough. And so what we need to do is envision what that future is that we want to build. And that would be a better world. And that gives us a North Star and a place to start backcasting from, and not forecasting, but backcasting and saying, what would it take to get there? If we were living in this sort of Star Trek age, what would the next 100, 200 years look like that gets us there, or even 50, who knows? It might be faster than we think. I suspect that it might be exponential. So what does it look like to get there? And then if we go backwards from that goal, we can see, how do we start today? And what does my path look like to help build that? And how do I build systems and businesses and technologies or communities or whatever it is that I am good at doing to help us get there? And the more people that we have these conversations with, the more people we share these paradigms with, the more we can start having those same shared goals. Because right now, I don't think we do, right? We're, like I said, given these dystopian views of the future. And so all of us think that we're just going to goose walk into the Terminator. And we may. If we don't take hold of the reins and build the future that we want, none of us are victims. Some of us get victimized, but none of us are victims here. Like we are all playing a role or could be playing a role in building a better future. And the amount of wealth that it takes to do that is lower than ever. The amount of coordination and collaboration that you can do without more resources is better than ever, right? And so we're getting all of these really empowering tools all around the same time that we can pull this off, I think. And so we need to focus on what it is we want to pull off and how we plan to get there instead of, hey, trend Oracle, tell me where the world is going to go and I'll just be along for the ride as it falls off a cliff. So it's important for us to recognize that there are grand challenges and that I am not minimizing them whatsoever. Climate change is real. It's huge. We're already seeing immense disastrous impacts of it. There's a lot of social instability that's happening that's pretty dangerous. And if we don't find ways of countering disinformation and misinformation and finding ways of understanding each other and understanding what's going on in the world, we'll be in trouble. But there's great solutions. I actually, you know, I just shut down a website that I built years ago called Spectrum Report. I think people at Ground News are doing a great job of this. And, you know, I've got other things going on, but I'm just going to have to let this go. But the good news is other people are building it, and that's great. And so, like, looking at how do you, one, break yourself out of an echo chamber by looking at what's being said on the left or the right or purple, brown, green, whatever, as first, and then looking at what are the narratives that are sort of between the lines in this information, and then which of those narratives are actually true. Some of the information could be true, but being used strategically to give you a view of the world that is untrue. And there's plenty of examples of that, but I don't really want to get into a political conversation. So there's ways that technology can help us to process information in the world. I think artificial intelligence is going to be a great help in that because it can process a lot of this. When I started Spectrum Report, I tried to recruit some AI engineers that could help build something that was basically an LLM that would sort through all of these different articles that were coming out of different outlets across the left and right, looking at distilling what the narratives are on the right that support things like really strict immigration policies or whatever, or on the left that support the goals of the left. And then how do we fact check those narratives automatically so that we can see what's actually true and false about these? And we can start making decisions about the world and have a more accurate view of what the world is. So information is really important. I think artificial intelligence and this will help us.
That's at least if the AI is not fed. There's a new term. I forgot what the term is, but there are creators now that are creating things to poison AI data so that it's not utilizing all of the copyrighted and other material. But I guess in some ways it could be like how China owns TikTok and they can influence what Gen Z view and see because now they're using TikTok instead of Google to solve their problems. So, I mean, there's other issues that come up with how do we reduce that echo chamber and also make sure that if we're getting most of our information from AI, that that is also not corrupted by any state or other individual.
Absolutely. Yeah. And this has been a challenge for years, right? In advertising and what we've seen in elections with election meddling from foreign actors, right? That have gotten really good at influencing a society through message boards and social media and influencers, things like TikTok. And we could see a crumbling from within because of the influence of foreign actors or internal actors here. And this is a global phenomenon, right? This isn't just the US, this is across the world. But the way I think about it is through this framework called the Three Horizons, right? You've got some existing paradigm that's starting to lose its fit for purpose and starting to sort of decline. So we can see this with the carbon economy and with coal, oil, et cetera, right? We're starting to realize this has too many problems versus the benefits, and we've got some better technologies and we don't need this for everything. We're going to need oil for like all kinds of things in the future. There's no reason we should just be like setting it on fire so that we can move somewhere. It's a valuable resource. We should conserve it for better things and not pollute with it. So that's the horizon one, something that's losing its fit for purpose. This could be many other things. And then we start seeing this horizon three, which is little tidbits of the future. We're starting to see things like renewable energy and Teslas and whatever that are like, oh, we can start seeing like parts of what the future looks like. And we know there's a better future if we're able to leverage all of these things. But then there's horizon two, which is the conflict zone. And this is where these different alternatives compete for the future. And I think we're in that messy middle right now across many different areas. where you've got a declining establishment state or establishment industry. You've got rising new innovations and technologies. And then you've got this competition in the middle where, like, not only are they competing for who's going to win, but we as a society are competing and discussing and figuring out, how do we use this in the best way? How do we defend ourselves against disinformation campaigns? How do we defend ourselves against artificial intelligence that can crash the electrical grid or the minds of people if it's able to infiltrate social media in ways and create influencers that influence people in nefarious ways? Those are real problems that AI could create. And AI is probably, you know, what's going to help us to solve some of those problems, because we're not going to be able to keep up with it. But we need to figure it out. Will we? I don't know. I hope so. And I think so, but never know.
I do love that, though, that so new technology comes into place, and then we as a collective society then end up discussing the problems with this new technology. And then we would hope and account for the government to hopefully implement some of these policies to make sure that we still have an economic system that favors the people over the individual, and everybody's rights and whatnot are protected, so that we're maintaining kind of the status quo to some extent. But still, if we look historically at society, is that you as an individual, no matter how poor you are, you're still living better off than a king did in the 16th century. You have running water, you have access to medical, and you can basically do whatever you want, whenever you want. And so we still have more freedoms. We're still so much better off. And the hope and the goal is that we will end up having technology and new problems, but it creates a freer, more open society where we can hopefully derive a greater sense of meaning. Because I know that now we're at the Maslow's hierarchy of pyramid of needs, and we're kind of going closer and closer to the top, which necessitates answering for more individuals at society, how do we have meaning if money isn't as meaningful as I once thought it did? So with that in mind, what advice or direction do you have for whether it's, say, somebody like me who's already been a successful entrepreneur? And I've wanted to have an impact on, I wanted to feel that thing that I'm making a difference, but I'm also afraid of investing money into something that I don't know anything about, or even what's the best way. Should I try and start a company about climate change when I don't know anything about it? Should I just find some VC companies that I can maybe work with? And also, how do you, as a smaller entrepreneur, how do we change them so that we're not just always creating content or solving an app to get more money? How do we change that shift so that we have more people who want to become entrepreneurs as a function of making an impact and are willing to take the risk necessary in order to achieve that?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think part of it is around recognizing the opportunity. We just need to flip some of these conversations on their head and say, instead of, hey, these are a bunch of problems and so give up, like, here's a bunch of opportunities, go solve a problem. And then the second part is know thyself, right? Like, who are you and what do you enjoy doing? What are you good at? And therefore, what can you do in the world that's going to have a positive impact? Maybe you're really good at marketing and you love getting people excited about something. That could be a great opportunity as an influencer to raise awareness around an issue and get things moving, or be a marketing person at a startup. Maybe you really love, you know, exploring new ideas and, you know, figuring out what's next and do some scenario planning and figure out some visions of what that future could look like. Maybe you love just giving yourself a checklist and ticking off boxes and getting shit done. Maybe you just need to, like, figure out what that checklist is so you can go execute on it and just knock it out of the park. Maybe you like to analyze things, right? Maybe you like to take things apart and figure out how they work. Maybe you like to criticize, hey, these are crazy ideas. Like, here's 27 reasons why that won't work. Even though all these different types of people annoy the shit out of each other, they're really valuable to have in the same room because they balance each other really well if they can recognize the value that each other is bringing to the table. So you need the explorers who are out there kind of out front scouting and figuring out where what could happen. You need the people who are the exciters who go out and get, you know, people really excited about what could be and how this might happen. You need the people who analyze and say, don't you want to bring water on this trip? And then you need people who are really executing and just getting things done. And so I think part of just knowing yourself and knowing what role you play is really valuable. And then also sort of flipping sort of idea of privilege on its head, like you touched on, that sure, even some of the poorest people in America, at least, are more well off than many kings. And even if that's not your immediate property or anything that you own, the resources you have access to are immensely more than someone did not too long ago. And I'm not trying to say that privilege doesn't exist in many areas, and underprivilege definitely exists, right, in many ways. But I think from a personal perspective, when we're starting to think about what we can do as people, is looking at, instead of what are all the reasons that I'm disadvantaged and what are all the ways that I don't have privilege and someone else has it, it's a good place to start. But next, we really quickly need to go to, what are the privileges that I have, whether that's financial or political, which are sort of the traditional ways of looking at it. But what about community privilege? Or what about educational privilege or access to information or living near a place that does have resources or people who are smart and can do these things, or having a computer so that I can get these things done? So start flipping it into, what are the privileges that I really do have? And how can I leverage those to help people who don't have it? How can I leverage the privileges that I'm afforded and be not only grateful for them, because that makes me happier as a human being, but how can I think about how to use those in ways that are going to impact the world in a positive way? And I think that kind of shift in mindset, and then the focus on knowing yourself and what you're good at, and then figuring out what you really care about. I kind of see it in two different ways. There's some people who, there's two types of people in the world, right? Let's say there's people who want to have a large amount of impact on a few number of people, and they want to look those people in the eye, and they want to feel the impact they've had and the gratitude. These are people who are teachers, firefighters, police officers, you name it. And then there are some people who are like, I'm okay with having a small amount of impact on a large number of people. And I think often these are more of the entrepreneurs and people who get into politics for the right reasons, or business, et cetera. And that's my judgment for what's right or wrong. But those different things motivate people differently. I worked with someone in tech who used to be a firefighter. And, you know, we work on a renewable energy and sustainable business. And he said, you know, I just really miss being able to look people in the eye that I saved, and knowing that I saved that person's life. I've really felt like a hero. And he's like, I have a hard time with this because I know we're doing something good, but I just don't get to see it. I'm not close enough to it. And I totally respect that. That's 100% true for him. And myself, I kind of think about impacting a large number of people. It can be a smaller amount. I love one-on-one and impacting people. I've done tutoring and education and stuff, and it's really, really meaningful and rewarding. But also, I think we need some of these sort of big picture concepts. We need to unleash ourselves to be free to think about what the world could be without the constraints that we put on ourselves today, and without the sort of judgment that comes along with it. I feel like, you know, the word optimist has become a sort of a bad word in a lot of ways, right? Because it implies being naive. It implies not understanding fully what's going on. And not everybody has to be an optimist, but we have to be willing to imagine what could go right and how the world might work out so that we can build in that direction and try our best to make that happen. Because if we don't, 100% sure it's not going to happen, right? If we try our best, we may build it. We may overcome these challenges. I think we probably can. I think it's a likelihood. But if we don't even try, there's zero likelihood we're going to get there. And we're not going to feel great about it when it hit. I'm just like, God, I wasted all that time and all those years building this sock delivery app, you know, when I should have been trying to do something about something I knew was important to humanity and to our future. So yeah, focus on that. You know, think about not only environmental, but abundance. So I like to think about it in terms of sustainable abundance. So classic 2x2, right? We've kind of gone from unsustainable scarcity, where nobody really had much. Whatever we build was pretty unsustainable. We just burned stuff and ran buffaloes off of cliffs and killed all the mammoths, right? And we still didn't have that much. We've sort of shifted up that scale to unsustainable abundance, where we have much more available. And more people have more resources and more access to information and healthcare and all kinds of things. You know, we could shift to sustainable scarcity, which is what some people are pushing back on. I don't think that's the goal of many people, but what would that look like? It would look like authoritarianism, where there's immense amounts of control. Everyone has to live in these cold, dark apartments and don't move around too much because you might spend too much carbon, right? This is the fear of the sustainable world, which is nobody wants and nobody's pushing for. But I think that's more of an authoritarian approach, which leads to social collapse. And so it won't work anyway. So I think the only viable future for humanity is sustainable abundance. And the good news is that the much more fun and better world for all of us to live in anyway is one where we can go out and try to live our dreams and pursue happiness and try to figure out our limits as a species. And we can do so in a way that's not destroying the planet that we depend on, because without ecology, there's no economy. And so we need to be able to reach that level, and all of us have a part to play.
I really absolutely love all your views. And frankly, that's quite rare for me to have a conversation with somebody in which I agree we need the optimism. You have the realistic optimist, which is probably the best way of looking at it. And I love the perspective that you can either be somebody who wants to have a large impact on a few amount of people or a small impact on a large amount of people. And those being a way that creates that inner fire, that drive, that ambition that allows us to kind of go on this journey that we all have on ourselves. And then the concept of sustainable abundance, in that we should be in a society in which we all have equal access to various technologies, and we're able to maintain that without ruining the planet that we're all kind of, you know, on the spaceship flying through Earth. And so you touch on so many different kind of core concepts about privilege, about meaning, about being, say, less individualistic as a society, and even having like a mindset that is shifting from what's preventing and blocking me from what is inspiring me. What kind of philosophies, I know this is a broad question, but there's so many individual views that you have within this wider argument. And I'm wondering what impacts, what have you read, what influences from all of these perspectives? I know it's a broad question, but privilege, individualism, mindset, is there anything that kind of pops to your mind as like something that either myself or the listener can go and view?
Great question. Difficult one to answer. Hard to distill, but I think that Jeremy Rifkin book, Zero Marginal Cost Society, is a really good one. It's a really good way of thinking about how economics could work towards our betterment. There's things like Life 3.0 by Max Tegmark, which is a great way of thinking about artificial intelligence, I think, where we're creating a new form of life that's able to not only evolve its hardware as we've done, we've been able to evolve our software with culture. But with artificial intelligence, we're taking it to that 3.0 next step. So there's a lot of really interesting frameworks there. Yeah, there's so many good books. There's a book called How to Save the World by Katie Patrick. That's a fun, optimistic, and like visually exciting book. And there's just so much out there. I mean, in terms of philosophies, I think I've always been interested in philosophy and love Nietzsche as much as I love Camus and, you know, a lot of these other thinkers that help you to understand what your own take is. And you don't have to be one or the other. You don't have to be a federalist. You don't have to be a localist. You don't have to be a nihilist or an optimist. We're all of the above, right? And that's for good reason, that there's a good time to be a nihilist and there's a good time to be an absurdist. And so I think those are good resources. And I think just thinking about it in terms of, like you said, we're on this little beautiful crystal of living things, this biosphere floating through a very cold, infinite universe that probably has other life and probably has all kinds of forms of consciousness and stuff, and definitely is more complex than we know. But that perspective is helpful, and it's helpful to think about how short our lives are. You know, I mean, I recently lost my father, unfortunately, and I was there with him when he died, and I've always tried to hold death close. And I think that just sort of really reinforced that idea and that thinking that, you know, when you're thinking about what you're doing in life and you're making decisions about what to do, like, think about yourself when you're 90 years old, let's say, and you're on your deathbed, you've got a week left to live, and say, hey, 90-year-old dying Justin, what would you do in this situation? Should I jump? Should I go for it? Or should I like play it safe? Often that person's going to be like, yeah, screw it, have fun. You're going to end up here one way or the other. But there's got to be a balance where you plan like you're going to live forever, but you live like you're going to die tomorrow. And so everybody's got their own calculus on how they get to that point. But yeah, I think just absorb as much as you can and then look within for the wisdom that you can find to help you develop along your own path.
Yeah, I think that life is in some ways, it's trying to balance the amount of hedonism that we seek in the short term, but also recognizing that, say, working really hard to accomplish something that you can feel proud of, that is also a form of happiness, just as much as alcohol, sex, or drugs is. And being able to find that balance between those two, I think what it can allow us to build that positive version of society without being, without having this perpetual burnout that we're seeing so often from where we are now.
Right. Like, you know, drug, sex, and rock and roll, all of that is sacred in the right amounts, right? Like going to a music festival and dancing your heart out is one of the most beautiful things you can do. But also building a business that you believe in and having impact on the world is also incredibly important. If you burn yourself out to the point where you just can't even feel or think anymore, then that's over the top. Like there are periods where you have to work late and, you know, skip sleep for a night. But over the long term, everything in moderation.
And so I know that you have a website. If they're interested, where should people go if they want to follow your ideas and hear more of what you have to say?
Yeah, the book is a great place to start. It's called What Could Go Right? Designing Our Ideal Future to Move from Continual Crises into a Thriving World. And so there's a lot of these ideas and a lot more there, where I really had a chance to talk to people and interview people and come to some of these ideas and conclusions and also think through what that world might look like from the Maslow's hierarchy of needs scale if we adapted it to society. And so there's a lot of interesting stuff in there. That's a good place to start if you like these types of conversations. On Twitter, I'm Jay Beano. And then if you want to reach out, I'm at justincbean.com.
Justin Bean, thank you for being here. It was an absolute pleasure. I learned so much and would definitely be following up with you.
Thanks so much, Cody. This is a great conversation. I really appreciate you bringing me into it and being such a great leader of this podcast. Yeah.